Welcome once again, dear listeners, to Food Conversation Season 5. Now, before we begin, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today we are going to welcome to the studio two courageous and dedicated persons who have started a bold venture to enhance regenerative agriculture in the Shuswap. 2.5 years ago, Ron and Jennifer St. Marie purchased a large tract of land in the Notch Hill area south of Sorrento and brought to it their 3 decades of commitment to improving human health and well-being by bringing us into right relationship with our planetary home. Welcome, Ron and Jen, to Food Conversation.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for that glowing introduction. I hope we're going to live up to that.
I just picked up the truth from you guys. So why don't we just start, not at the beginning or at the end, but right in the middle of what's happening to your lives right now. 2.5 years ago, you purchased over 100 acres of land, some of it cultivated, some of it wild, but all of it open and accessible to your dream of implementing regenerative and restorative growing practices on the land. Now, prior to this, you had spent 30 years living in Kamloops, Ron as a teacher, and Jennifer is an occupational therapist, but this was your first venture into farming your own land. Had you been thinking about having a farm for a long time?
Not for a long time. We'd been volunteering on farms for about 10 years before that, but we hadn't considered owning our own farm until maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
So what was the trigger? What's the thing that pushed you over the edge, as it were?
We felt that we needed to do something to address climate change and all the other problems that we're facing, like biodiversity loss and local food security, these sorts of things. And so we decided we might as well try and do our part. And this opportunity came up, so we took the plunge.
Ron, what was motivating you in your heart? What was it that made having your own land to do this on so important?
I don't know if this is curious or not, but we pretty much have the same take on this together.
That is curious.
There has not needed to be a whole lot of what you might call negotiation about this. We understand that there's a climate crisis, a biodiversity crisis. I'm repeating what Jennifer said, but this is it. You asked me the question, and we both basically answer it the same way.
Yeah.
If we don't do something, who will?
Yeah,
it comes down largely to that.
Stepping up to the plate, as they say.
Things need to be done. We see this as a start to doing something for 6 or 7 generations down the line. We see ourselves as stewards rather than owners of this land. I think that's fair to say, and it has an enormous amount of potential. We feel fortunate to be there. It's somewhat overwhelming. No, it's very overwhelming. But there we are. We're making a stand.
Jennifer, you'd mentioned a film you'd seen about food deserts in urban settings.
Correct.
How did that affect you when you saw that and playing into what we're talking about now?
Right. So that was a while back in Kamloops. There was a film festival, and one of them was about the food deserts in Detroit, and we watched that, and a local urban farmer named Curtis Stone was also speaking, and afterwards Ron says, well, I think I could do urban farming, which was quite a shock to me because I'd never thought about that. I didn't think he had either.
Oh, I hadn't, but there was a good movie.
You didn't know he had it in him.
I was convinced.
The power of film.
There we go. Persuasive, well made.
Yeah. And so we just decided we would start in our backyard and learn about farming and learn about doing it in a way that benefited the land rather than destroyed it. And
the rest, as they say, is history.
And then we scaled up.
Scaled somewhat to 126 acres.
The thing about that film is that it showed what ordinary people can do in ordinary circumstances.
Right, right.
I didn't see this thing and think, oh, look, I can become a hero of some kind. These are regular people. learning how carrots come from the earth.
Democratizing performance.
Well,
you don't have to be a professional.
So, right. So that was one of the things that was impressive about it, or attractive about it.
Now, the purchase process is a very much a material process. How did that come about? What were the steps that you took there?
It's still hard to believe that so many institutions turned us down. I can't believe it. I mean, what are we here?
Isn't that supposed to be a mark of distinction if you have a wall papered with rejection notice for something?
No.
But it's not fun.
I think we got our mortgage finally from the eighth institution, you know. It took months. I don't know why, because we had we have a clean record in that regard. We had a house to sell. It was odd. So you asked about that process. I mean, it took perhaps longer than it ought to have, but it gave us a chance to get to know the land. We volunteered on that farm for that period of time, that summer, while we were looking to secure a mortgage for it. We volunteered on the farm, and the previous owner was kind enough to show us the ropes and let us know how she grew beans and carrots and things like that.
That's a very practical thing, Jen. That you could see the land in action, as it were.
True, yeah. And it gave us good experience of one way of managing that land. And
made you think about how you would manage the land.
Well, not exactly at that point, but the last 2.5 years have given us that experience.
Ample opportunity to reflect on this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was not only a personal commitment, but it was also a financial commitment. You were stretching your resources. It wasn't just, let's walk in and take a fragment of our wealth and spend it on. This was pretty close to the bone for you guys.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, but when you feel like you have a calling to do something, you can't not do it.
Well, I think a lot of people listening to this program will probably echo that sentiment. There's a lot of people involved in producing food in new and better ways, which are really old ways that we just sort of forgot about. Now, this venture was not, as they say, your first rodeo. Ron, you come from the Franco-Manitoban community in Manitoba.
Yep.
And Jen, you're a Vancouver girl.
Right.
But you didn't meet in this country. You met in Germany.
There you go.
Studying
there you go.
Language and culture.
Yeah.
What was that like? Did you, was it like, oh my goodness, a Canadian girl or a Canadian boy? Or how did that come about?
I guess I went over because I wanted to learn German in order to be able to work in Europe. And I ended up in Switzerland in this French speaking part. So it wasn't so practical.
Well, then Ron could help you with that.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, we just happened to be in the same language school, and I happened to injure my ankle when walking home from school one day, and Ron very kindly carried me home.
There you go.
And little did you know what
beast
you're getting
burden.
Into. Yes. Well, it's okay. So it's an honorable role. And but Germany then became an important part of your life together. You went back and forth numerous times.
Yeah.
At one point, I think you did a teacher exchange.
That's right.
With what was by now a tribe of about five plus.
The two of you. Children.
Yes.
Yeah, we went there with 4 children, age 6 and under, that year.
What was that like? I mean, this is enhancing your sense of dedication, traveling across the Atlantic with 4 young children.
Why did we do that, Jennifer? Do you remember? Yeah.
Come on, Jen.
At that age, with that number of children, I don't know. It seems crazy now in retrospect, but there they were. There were 4 kids. The oldest was going into grade 1, as I recall. He did grade 1 there in German, not speaking a word of German.
Yeah.
And
But at the end of the year, he could speak.
Oh, yeah. Three of them could.
The kids are amazing.
Three older ones
just
could speak.
Just absorb it like a sponge, yes.
When that grade 1 child got back, he went into grade 2, and the people in the school questioned his abilities with reading and writing because he wrote things in German fashion.
Oh, the German script, you mean?
And spelling, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he'd misspell English words because he's spelling them a la German. And so there was a transition coming back, too. You know,
we were
kind of immigrants when we came back as well. But it was quite an experience. And we have friends there dating from that time and even before in Germany. It feels like our second home.
At one point, you were studying at an international school in the Black Forest.
That was that language school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was... Black Forest. When you were there, I mean, having wanted to do this, seeing it as a sort of a step in other directions, what was that like immersing yourself in a different culture? It must have given you a sense that cultures vary all over the world.
I would say that we really enjoy other cultures, and we enjoy learning what's different and maybe what's better.
So. Yes, sometimes it's not all in one box, is it?
Yeah, and... Yeah, but you can take what's good and what you learn that will work for you and add it to your own life.
So you were, and this was not the end of your travels or of your learning experiences. You went at one point to Denmark and then Sweden to study co-housing communities. Mm-hmm. What was that all about, Jen? What were you doing there?
Yeah, we decided to make a trip to Denmark and Sweden because they are famous for having brought back the idea of co-housing, especially in Denmark. And they have government regulations that support the idea. People are used to it in the culture there. So we wanted to see what they were doing because that's, we believe, is one thing that we need to foster in our country as well. The idea of community and working together and eating together, which is what really draws community together.
Mm-hmm. So what were some of the qualities of a co-housing which made it different from, say, people living in an apartment building? Obviously, there's some stark differences there.
Well, eating together was brought up by everyone as being one of the most important things that you can do on a regular basis.
Something we can bring out on this show as it's a food conversation
exactly.
show.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the more frequently you eat together, the better it is. Another idea is how you organize your buildings, the architecture, so that you are having people come together at various points on the property in order to do things like get your mail or do your laundry or whatever. And all your entrances, say, to your townhouses or however it's organized, come together rather than everyone sneaking out the back door.
So there's a structural thing, Ron.
Right.
This is infrastructure-generated interaction.
Yeah, and it didn't always come to all of those communities rationally. Some of them lucked into it, and some of them didn't luck into it, as we noticed, you know. But bringing people together for food and fun, for work and cooperation.
And seeing people in this part of the world living in structures that don't necessarily do that. Did you find a bit of re-entry shock when you came back to...
Oh. I'm not sure. I mean, we weren't gone all that long, just a couple weeks, I guess. But a
couple of months.
They have at least in Denmark, they seem to have a far more communitarian view on how life ought to be lived. And that isn't easy to translate into this part of the world, you know. We're still pretty cowboy here. And,
yeah, we think of this as the Wild West, where you go out and you carve a habitation out of the wilderness, which is a false notion, but it's certainly very prevalent in our mindset.
And so, you know, we've been we lived in a housing co-op at one point, and we're interested in what some call intentional community. We'd love to be able to create that kind of thing on the land we live on. If we could find like-minded people who are willing to pitch in and, you know, share that vision, we'd love it. We need more hands in the dirt in general in regenerative agriculture.
But specifically what you mentioned, which is hands working together. They're sharing the burden, as
there
it were.
There you go. Absolutely.
Like when Jennifer couldn't walk, you were there to help her move.
Burden, yeah.
You also lived in Korea for a year. What was that? What was that, Jen? What took you to Korea? Obviously not learning Korean, I suspect.
No, but like I said, we do enjoy other cultures and we enjoy learning from them. So we thought our kids might enjoy that too. So we took all five of them this time. And
how old were they at that time?
The youngest was in grade 2 and the oldest was in grade 10.
Oh, they were almost fully mature.
So some of them virtual schooled and some were homeschooled and... yeah, it was a good time. Sometimes it's good to bring your teenagers out of their context at home.
Sure.
And show them what other possibilities there are.
Just remind listeners that, once again, that I'm speaking with Ron and Jennifer St. Marie, who are owners of a farm in the Notch Hill area where all is well. So, Ron, what was your specific goal going to Korea?
Opening up the horizons for our children, giving them a chance to largely to see the world. Plus, we like that. You know, we met in Germany. We went back to live there afterward. So here's the thing: we had no idea we'd end up in Korea. I took a year's leave of absence from my teaching job in Kamloops, and we started looking around for work. We found that it was pretty much impossible to get a job in Europe because there was always European passport preferred. So we had to start looking further afield. Now, when that school year ended, we had a house and a mortgage and five kids and no job to go to earn our living for the next year. So we didn't find a job, any job really, until partway through that summer. It happened to be in Korea. Why these people took an interest in us, I'm not entirely sure. We had five children. That was an impediment as well. Hmm. I was talking, you know, I talked to private schools here and there, and what they really ideally wanted were two teachers, no kids, right? And here we had five kids. Why these people fell for our ruse, I don't know, but they did hire me, us. They hired us both,
What did they hire you for?
To teach ESL, English Second Language, to children aged from about 4 to 50, roughly.
50-year-old children.
Yeah.
There's a few of them around.
Yeah. And so we went. They offered us a job. We put our house in storage. We put it up for rent. We took advantage of the plane fares they offered us. We got on the plane to Korea. We landed. We took an all-night bus trip down to the town we were supposed to live in. It was real Twilight Zone stuff. Absolutely.
Well, Twilight Zone didn't deter you because you did other work overseas or out of the country. One of the places you went to was a small farm in Mexico named in English, chamomile, which is La Manzanilla.
Uh-huh.
What were you doing on that farm? This was obviously whetting your appetite, Jen, for actual farm work.
Well, a friend of ours in Sorrento, he and his wife spend the winter in Mexico, and he had started this little farm in La Manzanilla. And we said, oh, we can come down and help. And so we did. And that's one of our favorite spots in the world now.
Yeah.
So how many times have you been back now?
Just three. But
just three.
Well, we went three times. COVID hit.
The farm, we can't get away now.
Now we have, yeah.
But, yeah.
So the thing is, that farm was associated with a middle school there, and it was intended partly as an educational venture. Yeah. So we followed our friends Peter and Linda down there, and they would spend 5 or 6 months down there every winter. We only went for 3 or 4 weeks at a time, I guess.
And you went
like
out
that.
In the fields.
Oh yeah.
And worked. Got your hands dirty.
We'd spend the mornings working, and then come home for when it just got too hot for us.
A siesta
for lunch. Wash your clothes and siesta.
Yeah. A very civilized behavior.
Yeah. Spend the afternoon doing that and take a walk on the beach. It was lovely. It's a great little place, you know. There isn't a single traffic light. There are two stop signs, I think, that everybody completely ignores.
Hmm.
And they have a beautiful beach, and it's Mexico. But, you know, we start thinking a little bit more about how much carbon we use going down there. I mean, oh, geez, it's terrible to have a conscience about everything.
Yes.
Maybe you should cut that part out. you know, do we fly down there? I don't know how we're going to continue that.
Ron, I think everyone on planet Earth who's aware of what's going on is ambivalent about something, because you're doing something that is enhancing the planet's, you know, overall health and metabolism. Yeah. And at the same time, you could be doing things that are detracting from it. It's just something we as a collective entity, the human species, has to come to terms with. Now, diverting a little bit to some of the things that matter to you personally, and there's a slight difference in focus, but obviously it works very well together. Ron, music is an important thing for you. And all kinds of music.
Yeah, it is, actually.
What's What are some of your favorite kinds of music, or the music that you would play yourself?
Oh, interesting.
Which question. Is two, not necessarily the same.
I like variety. I'll listen to many, many things. I'm not so much, into really hard stuff. Hmm. I am almost 70 years old. After
all. You need to preserve your eardrums.
I listen to all kinds of stuff. I love variety. The kind I make mainly is sort of rootsy. Hmm. I have a copy of my album to give you one before I leave. Do you have anything you can play a CD player, CD on?
I have a CD player somewhere. If I dig around, I can probably find it.
No, that's it. And, you know, when it comes to music, you know, that's the reason I wanted to learn German. That's largely the reason Jennifer and I met. I started listening at a certain point in my life to classical music, which I wasn't introduced to in my home as a child. And I realized that a lot of it, with the language was German. And I thought, geez, I should be able to learn this language so I could listen to it directly. I started learning German, and it's one great motivation for learning the language, and that brought us together.
I had a 33 and a third recording of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony that I played 350 times when I was about 7 years old. Uh-huh. So I can understand some of your musical aspirations. For you, Jen, it was more artistic ventures that were sort of your solace and your pleasure. Why don't you talk about some of those?
Yeah, I managed to obtain a diploma in printing, painting, and drawing over a course of about 10 years.
That's the best way. It seasons it nicely, doesn't it?
But that was sort of what I did as a mother for myself, to take one course a year, sort of. And then, yeah, when I find time, I can paint and draw. I haven't had much time since we bought the farm, though.
Yes, work has moved forward in your lives.
She did the cover art for the album I recorded.
Now, you mentioned learning and exploring new things, and we've been talking about that quite a bit. Both of you have had lots of interests. Ron, you taught soccer, coached soccer. De novo. A friend said, could you do this? And then bogged off almost immediately and left you in charge.
10 years later, I'm still doing it.
Exactly. And Jen, the interest in health as an occupational therapist broadened, and it included lots of different kinds of what are sometimes called complementary and alternative medicine, but are really other kinds of tools for health. How did that sort of evolve in your thinking?
Mainly that came about through various health crises.
That'll do it.
Yeah, that's right. So once you start realizing that someone in your traditional line of medicine that you've been involved in isn't going to be able to help you, you start looking somewhere else. And we were fortunate enough to, you know, come in contact with other forms of medicine, such as homeopathy and healing touch and those sorts of things.
How did that work for you, broadening, you know, raised in, you know, trained in a conventional discipline like occupational therapy, which is pretty grounded, if you might say, but doesn't necessarily include these other kinds of therapies? How did that feel to realize that there were all these other ways of looking at things and doing them?
It's kind of like our interest in other cultures, right? And so just being able to look at things more holistically was really important to me, because quite often our Western medicine, at least at that point, I think it's improved somewhat, but didn't include anything more spiritual or making the connection between the physical and the emotional and mental and the spiritual, all influence one another. We tend to focus on the physical. And
yeah, I don't think it's much better yet, but it's being dragged kicking and screaming to a notion of inclusiveness, which is a real challenge. You're also involved with the transitional committee, a community rather, in Kamloops. Jen, what was that like for you? This must have seemed pretty much up your right up your alley.
Right. So that happened after we saw that film on urban agriculture in Detroit, that a group of people decided to have a large meeting in Kamloops to bring together people who are interested in the same thing and start what was at that time called Transition Towns, but is now the Transition Movement. And So I've been involved with that since, well, at least 2012. And I think that's another reason that I felt that agriculture was one of the most important things that we can do in order to make that transition, because there's it addresses so many of the concerns at once. It provides the things we need while also improving or like helping to sink carbon and helping to restore land while providing us with food and hopefully developing community around that.
There's this ancient notion of breaking bread together, whether you break bread or you eat an olive or have a beverage. It's something that seems to work for everybody everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And food and love are often collated. They often relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you guys were being inexorably dragged towards owning your own land where you could start to do things. Mm-hmm. But before I go there, permaculture, the concept of permaculture started to come into your thinking. Ron, that was...
Yeah, I mean, of course, the name comes from permanent agriculture, shortened to permaculture, but it's a set of organizational principles, I guess you could say, that
allow you to design.
Yeah, in they can design your life, not just your agriculture.
Sure,
right. And a lot of the principles come from Aboriginal societies, how to create and maintain systems that are self-sustaining, do not continually require outside input. And of course, industrial agriculture requires constant outside input.
And one of the important principles is also bringing different kinds of life forms, plants in particular, together
is important.
As a unit.
Absolutely.
Bring them all together.
Yeah. I mean, the natural world is diverse.
It's about ecological systems, which
sure.
we are a part.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remind listeners again that I'm speaking today with Ron and Jennifer St. Marie, who are the proud owners of a large land space south of Sorrento, where they are doing some wonderful things in bringing forward regenerative notions with respect to land and to growing things. And
we are Notch Hill Community Growers.
Notch Hill Community Growers. That will be forever recorded on this.
As we wish to grow other things other than plants and animals, we wish to grow community.
Absolutely. So. And that's obviously, you know, part of the theme of your lives, if you want to call it that, is reaching out to enhance community relations.
Yep.
Something that I think is pretty much a universal phenomenon and was always part of our ancient history, but has sort of gotten a little bit sidelined in the last 50 to 70 years. And now you and many others are starting to bring it back. Why don't we talk a little bit about values? We're talking about a holistic relationship with our surrounds, the land, the people. What values have, if you could summarize, Ron, sort of some core values that have sort of moved you, because we'll be talking about the land in a moment that you're on, but how would you say you could summarize this sort of core values that have guided you?
I think it's about love, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Loving each other, loving our neighbors as ourselves, loving the creation. All these things have to work together to
motivate.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. That works. When we were selling our home in Kamloops, a couple came through to see it. A couple who had only heard through the grapevine we were selling, because we hadn't had put a sign up yet. And they came by and they took a look at it. They looked at all over somewhat thoroughly, you know, a first mm-hmm. first look inside and out. And the woman said, "We love this place. We can feel the love in it." Imagine that.
Just imagine. I am imagining that.
We could feel the love in a house, you know?
Yes.
And that is unforgettable for me, that someone I don't know can come into my home and say that about the environment. And so that's what we want to recreate where we are.
Was that not also validating for you? I mean, you put so much of your heart and soul into projects, we can say around the world, where you're trying to help people and do positive things for the ecosystem in which you are living at that given time. Didn't this feel like somebody's recognizing it at last? I mean, not at last.
Maybe not at last, but in a way that was completely unexpected. I mean, we often think, well, we typically think about real estate as real estate, as just objects to buy and sell. And when someone comes into your home and says, we like this, we'd like to buy it, largely because we feel the love in the place, it is affirming. It's surprising. And it's encouraging to think that we are capable of doing that in spite of ourselves, perhaps. And we're looking to recreate that kind of thing where we're living now. Now, where we lived in Kamloops, we raised 5 children there. And now we need another kind of community on this land to sort of replicate that love in community.
Speaking for a moment of those 5 human beings that you brought into the world, how do you see them relating to what you're trying to exemplify in your lives, Jen, as the mother figure, officially?
Well, they claim that they would never want to live on the farm. However, there's other things that belie that. For instance, 2 of them have taken permaculture courses. One of them has then gone on to a master gardener course, and the other one went to develop her own gardening business in Victoria while working at a florist and working in the arts.
So she's trying to cover all of her parents' in initiatives.
Well, there she go. Yeah. So, apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
And what else? Another one has worked a number of years in landscaping, mm-hmm. and another one really enjoys going to Karamias to pick fruit.
Doesn't even know why, just automatically feels drawn to go and pick fruit in Karamias.
And he gives swing dance lessons on the beach in the evening.
So music, agriculture, covering the parental goals.
Yeah,
but it must be also validating to see that your kids have picked up on the essence, not necessarily the exact form, but the essence of what you're trying to present to them in your lives.
That's well put.
Yes, that's a good way to say it.
Okay, now we're back on the land.
On the land.
In Sorrento.
126 acres.
You'd worked on other farms before, but this was your own farm.
Yeah.
How did that change things for you?
Oh.
Well, we have to be there 7 days a week instead of...
you can't say, going to Korea for a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Seriously up the ante. You know, there's so much to do, and there are only 2 of us still. So, well, we do have... I shouldn't say that, because we do have friends who come and help, and we gladly accept volunteer help on the farm, in part because we volunteered on farms for years, and we in some sense paid it forward, and we give people a chance to contribute to what we're trying to do. So,
and you also have a sense that this is a relationship between you and them, but mm-hmm. also between them and the land mm-hmm. simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. That's all true.
Yes, we're quite interested in education, and having been a teacher and me a therapist, allowing people to come to an understanding of where their food comes from, what it's like to be on the land and connected to nature, and how important this is.
You actually formulated some of the generalities that we're talking about into some principles. I understand there were 5 principles that you were trying to embody in this venture. Mm-hmm. What were they? Ron, do you want to...
5
As a teacher, do you want? They say that teachers should only teach 5 things in each lesson. So
5? Okay.
Yeah, that's
well,
teacher school.
To create community, to farm regeneratively, to increase biodiversity, to please
address
help me out,
local food security,
address local food security and climate crisis.
Hmm.
And
how did that feel, being able to exemplify these or embody these values in your own venture? I mean, as proponents and principals in this process, Jen, was it intimidating? Like, the buck stops with us now?
It's challenging, for sure. what we really want to be able to do is in permaculture, you think of something, you think of one principle as being to stack functions. So how can we do all of those things in a way that addresses them all rather than trying to segregate them all into different parts?
Integration, as they call
it. Yeah, integrate them all, because that's A, more efficient, and also more effective.
That's a fascinating notion, and I would guess in some respects, in the culture that women are embedded in, that is often what you end up doing as, not just as mothers, but also in terms of managing 10 things at once. It's not an unfamiliar concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to focus as well. Like, we're trying to really not try and do too many different things, right?
Sure.
So at the same time as you want to be able to address all those things at one time, it's really not a good idea to try and do multiple goals in different directions.
Yeah, they have to be harmonious to some degree.
Yeah.
Ron, what was the process for drawing up these five fundamental goals? Did it just, 2 minutes scribbling on an envelope on the kitchen table? Or
I'm
was
not
it
sure I recall the process, but I mean, we spent most of a decade studying these things, studying permaculture, looking at what needed to change if we were going to have a world for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. As far as the process goes, it was kind of natural for us. We talked it through. I don't know. Can you add something to that?
It just flowed.
It kind of did. I mean, there was no flow chart on the bedroom wall with.
There was.
Well, there was. There was. but regarding
we have spies everywhere, Ron. So be.
But
be
regarding
careful.
Regarding specifically these five, did we bring in a consultant of any kind?
We watch a lot of YouTube videos and,
consultancies are popping up everywhere, and being a little selective is an important step in that process.
Yeah.
Now, you both described this, the words that you're using talking about the last couple of years was a blur and a whirlwind.
Yeah.
And blurs and whirlwinds only do well if you've got a clear set of principles that are animating everything. The principles have to be clear, and that's what we've just been talking about. These five, and just those are the enunciations, but there's obviously a matrix in which these principles are embedded, and it doesn't take, once you've got them set, you're just moving ahead saying, does this fit in? Of course it does. So some of the things that you've done, first of all, you invited other people to come and join you on the property and be part of what you were doing. I think you initially had a family there, but they were gone after the first season. But you've had other people sort of in and out and coming together. What's that been like, Jen? Getting the people to come and understand your values and that kind of thing?
Well, the first year that we were there, we had quite a number of volunteers and work parties because it was during COVID and people needed a place to go that was outside to have some, sort of social contact. But as things opened up afterwards, we have had fewer volunteers other than some very faithful ones. And we do have community in the sense that we have two or three other farmers and one beekeeper who also are active on our land. So that's one type of community. There's so many different ways to look at community.
Well, in a formal sense, Ron, you've also together worked on setting up a farmers' institute from sort of Chase to Sorrento, that kind of area.
Chase and Area Farmers Institute.
That's and how's that gone? What kind of resonance have you had in the communities that you're connected to?
Well, I mean, we're in the early stages of this, but we just had a gathering at our home two nights ago. People around the table, we shared food, and then we dealt with our agenda, a meeting agenda. We're at the point where we're trying to let more people know who we are and get more out into the community. You have to establish who you are first before you can do any outreach of any kind. So we're kind of segueing from who we are to how we fit into the greater community. We all, present ourselves at farmers markets near and far. But what can we do beyond that to let people know? So we're right now we're planning a bit of a farm tour for September. So let the community know who we are, and they can come out and learn about X at this farm and Y at another farm and A and B and C at other farms. And we'll hone that as time goes on. But we want to get into the community. Yeah.
One thing that I and many others have learned from our Indigenous friends and neighbors is that you understand things best when you're on the land, when you're right there and you can see what's going on, as opposed to reading in a book or having somebody tell you about it, you know, at second or third hand. Mm-hmm. One of the other things you're doing is you're moving towards perennial crops, things that come back year after year that are not requiring extensive, and this is part of the permaculture process as well. You let the ecosystem manage itself when you've just given a little bit of a nudge. How's that coming along? Do you have a fruit tree here and there?
Well, we do, and we did plant some bush cherries, but this is the first year that we're making that transition. So in my mind, the most important thing is to prepare the land for that, and not try and stick a bunch of trees in the ground before that's done.
Sure. Organic farmers are always saying it's the soil.
Yeah.
You know, it's the quality of the soil that matters, and that sounds like that's an essential principle you're working on.
Right.
You also have a wetland that you're going to restore, or that you... I think the way you described it to me earlier was it still wants to be a wetland. How did you know it still wanted to be a wetland? What was it... How was it signaling that to you?
Well, one of the fellows, neighbor farmer that hays in that area, he reminds us that patch of land is very wet, stays very, very wet. And it seems obvious that it was a wetland at one point, because there is an existing wetland with a beaver lodge and all on the other side of the CP tracks. So CP cut that wetland in two. A friend of ours put a piezometer to measure the water. There's about 2 feet of soil in that field, and underneath it is some kind of a lake. There's a lot of water down there. So it's obvious what it really wants to do. And if we can get, when we get to the point where we can open it up and recreate the wetland, we'll give the area a chance to increase its biodiversity. The strength of biodiversity is the strength of the land. And I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, absolutely. And
we observed the land and we saw what it has. Yeah.
There's a shopping mall here in Saminam called Sentinoka Mall, and it was built on a wetland.
Hmm.
And the structural integrity of the buildings has been threatened ever since. There's settling, there's leakage, there's all sorts of things happening. And it's the exact opposite approach. At the time, it seemed like a good idea, but it's actually resulted in the owners and others struggling with trying to maintain what they think is important versus what Mother Nature and the landforms think is important, or no, it's what works for them. So, I mean, you're on a track that is now very much part of the scientific community's approach to these things, is to see what the land is structured for and then fit in with it rather than just riding roughshod over it.
Yeah.
Now, a concept that has become part of what you're doing is the concept of sociocracy.
Oh.
So let's talk about sociocracy. Ron, as the teacher in this crowd, would you please define sociocracy for us?
Oh, it's a way of organizing relationships and decision-making processes to include everybody and to safeguard your decisions against poor decisions. It's a way of
decisions.
Or no decisions.
Sure.
It's a way of coming to decisions that includes everybody, that must include everyone, and provides a process for reviewing those decisions, a natural built-in process to review. You know, for example, if you're on a board of some kind and you come to some kind of decision by Robert's Rules of Order, and it's done and it's set in stone, and you start to realize that something's not quite right. Well, down the road, if you want to bring that up and revisit it, you're sticking your neck out, because everybody put their stamp on this thing, and who are you to say that it's not quite working right? So in sociocracy, you have a built-in mechanism with every decision comes a timeline for review.
You used the phrase,
yeah,
good enough for now, safe enough to try.
That's exactly it. Good enough for now, safe enough to try. But we have a review mechanism in place, and nobody has to stick their neck out in order to request a review. It is part of the process, and it's so safe for people.
Well, the idea of good enough
for now
implies mm-hmm. that this is not necessarily a permanent mm-hmm. affair. Let's talk a little bit about the COVID, the pandemic, because that had a significant impact on everything you're doing. All the goodwill in the world met Mother Nature complaining about our interference with the metabolism of our planet. Jen, what effect did that have on your venture?
Well, it was another sign that we needed to do what we're doing. And it meant that the first year that we had these volunteers, but that the markets were not as strong as they had been because people were staying away. I don't know. What else could you
add? Well, you know, I mean, for example, the market in Sorrento is largely tourist-driven. So if you're not going to be able to sell as much or as well, you know,
because the tourists aren't coming.
At the same time, the year we moved in, there was a heat dome. It was not easy to produce vegetables working in plus 45 degree
I know
heat,
people have
and
had
there was nobody around to buy it.
Raspberries baked on the vine.
Absolutely. Currants baked on the vine, all kinds of things did. Yeah. The year after that, we had a really wet spring and then a drought for, four months? 4 months. So it's super topsy-turvy. We've come into this in a difficult moment, a very difficult moment for the land, for food production, for ourselves. And it's been a real challenge.
We're getting closer to the end of the show, and I wanted to talk about some of those principles because although you'd worked on other people's farms, you hadn't owned one yourself. Although you'd studied things like permaculture, you'd learned from different cultures, you'd traveled the world, taken your entire tribe to various settings with all the commitment and effort that entails. Underneath all this, there have to be a firm set of values, things that you believe are important. Jen, if you were summarizing what you see as the values that animate you, you talked about love before, and I think that's a principle. It's interesting here, scientists enunciating that notion, you know, there is love afoot in various kind of physical chemical processes, that kind of thing. But what is it that sustains you when there's a heat dome and there's a pandemic and there's people coming and and then moving on?
Well, of course, there's also our faith. Like I said, we feel we've been called to this. And when things are tough, we have to believe that it's going to work out because this is what we've been called to. So what can I say?
And so that's more than just a sort of a local or temporary thing. It's something that runs quite deeply through what you're doing.
Right, yeah.
Ron, your thoughts about that?
Ditto.
That was easy.
Well, I mean, that's the bedrock of it. We feel we've been called to do something. We've been called to show that it's possible to live and be different on the land. We've been called to do this. Many came before us, and we're looking for those who now want to come after us and join us. It's community among people. It's community people with the land, with the plants, with the animals, an integrated whole.
I think it's responsibility too.
Yes.
It's responsibility, yeah.
It's finally got to the point now where we can speak openly of spiritual values, not necessarily tied to a particular denomination or religion, but just underlying everything we do. We're doing it because there's a wholeness mm-hmm. that we want to bring out and foster.
Mm-hmm. And we're happy to acknowledge that. I mean, we must acknowledge that part of our makeup. And it's fundamental to who we are. So let's go with it. Don't deny it.
Yes, that's a very good point. Don't pretend.
Or avoid it. Don't deny it. Don't avoid it. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be ashamed of it.
Yes.
Live it.
And that's a wonderful note to end on, because it's saying that there are deeper values that drive us than just material ones or even locational ones. There are sort of universal values. I must admit, I have considerable admiration for you and your dedication and the value-driven work that you're doing, which more and more people I hear enunciating. They're not shrinking back from saying, I'm doing this because I truly believe this is the right thing, and in a way that does not offend others, that does not push other people away or establish competitiveness or differentiation. It says we're all in the same boat. And you said at one point we were talking, you said, Ron, this is no way to spend your retirement. And here you are wildly pursuing, but not wildly in the sense of, but just in a very dedicated way. And I think our listeners are probably inspired by what you're doing. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
I say that partly tongue-in-cheek, but I also, there's a certain truth there where people of a certain age who have fewer other responsibilities can now turn themselves to this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the notion of a mandatory retirement was for people who didn't like what they're doing or didn't believe in it. But when you do like it and you do believe in it, you can keep on doing it until your last breath. Thank you both very much
Thank
for
you
joining
for
us on
us.
Food Conversations.
Thank you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.